The treatment of children in trouble should be founded on the love of the child. This is the guiding principle of today's great life, the Victorian educationalist and penal reformer Mary Carpenter. She's the author of the wonderfully titled Reformatory Schools for the Children of the Perishing and Dangerous Classes and for Juvenile Offenders, published in 1851. In it, she says, love draws with cords far stronger than chains of iron. Mary Carpenter's work with the poorest and most troubled children helped bring about a great shift in British law and attitudes in the mid-19th century and spread her reputation around the world. She has something in common, then, with today's guest, the nominator of Mary Carpenter as A Great Life, the psychotherapist and founder of Kids Company, Camilla Batman-Gelage. In a word, Camilla, what does Mary Carpenter mean to you?
I think she had incredible moral courage. She was a visionary. When you think that it's nearly 150 years ago that she was talking about the power of love in delivering reparation to children, I think she's amazing.
Born in Iran to a wealthy family, Camilla was educated in Britain, and following the Iranian Revolution and the subsequent arrest of her father, she stayed here. Depending on your viewpoint, her exotic clothes, and I wish you could see them today, her exotic clothes, her extraordinary headdress and extrovert manner are irrelevant to, or actually help illustrate, the immense energy of her focus on vulnerable inner-city children. Camilla, Mary Carpenter was concerned mainly with poor and deprived children, children who lacked material means. Is it fair to say you're more concerned with the mental and emotional well-being of children?
I think if you actually read Mary Carpenter's work, she wrote about juvenile delinquents. And the introductory chapter starts with the fact that you get disturbed behavior in rich families as well as poor families, but that rich children are protected from the consequences of their disturbed behaviors often because they have a lot more resources to protect them against the consequences of the law. And I thought that was very insightful. And ultimately, what the book illustrates is that it's lack of love and care from parental figures that creates disturbance. And obviously, if you live in very deprived environments, you have an added challenge on top of that.
You said this. The way you do it is you put a collection of staff on the premises and let the children come when they like. Those who desperately need it will come 7 days a week. You provide three meals a day. You have your doctor, your dentist, your psychiatric nurse, optician, youth worker, artists and sports workers. You don't open and close files on children. You just get to know them. Do you think Mary Carpenter would have recognised that strategy?
Absolutely. I think she had a very similar strategy. And I was actually shocked to see the similarities when I read her work. I was absolutely stunned because I just came across her. And then I was thinking, oh my God, 150 years ago, this woman was talking about the power of love. And in fact, at Kids Company, we're currently doing research into the impact of loving care or lack of it on brain structural development and basically the child's ability to regulate emotion and energy. Love is the most extraordinarily potent intervention. But Mary Carpenter could only follow it through faith, and I'm hoping that in years to come we can actually demonstrate the power of love by evidencing it in science.
Well, to Mary Carpenter's approach next, and joining us to help with that is her biographer in progress, Carla Contractor. Carla, before I ask you about Mary's own life, can I ask you, as I did Camilla, how you became drawn to her story?
I lived in India for many years, and I was researching and teaching at the university about Raja Ram Mohan Roy. And when I came back to Bristol, I discovered his tomb, and very close to it in Arnisvale Cemetery, that of Mary Carpenter. And I set out to do something about not resurrecting them, but making them more prominent in the public eye.
Can I ask you first about Mary's early life, Carla? She had an unusually good education for a girl in the early 19th century. Why was that?
It was astonishing. Her father ran a very select boarding school within his house. 12 boys, and Mary was put in class with those boys. So she learned physics, chemistry, geology, maths, Latin, a bit of Greek, French, etc., as well as the normal subjects, the belles lettres and the history, geography, etc. So she had an extraordinarily good education.
Was his Unitarian Christian faith, well, one can argue about whether it's Christianity or not,
but indeed,
did that make him unusual and the family unusual in their attitudes?
It might have done in the wider circles across Britain, but Bristol at the time was a very nonconformist city, and the Unitarians were a power in the area. And Land Carpenter had an enormous Unitarian chapel, and he was a leading minister and very well accepted in Bristol society.
Carla, how about emotionally? Do you think her father was... They were very close, and that she meant a lot to...
Yes. As the oldest child, I think in some ways he groomed her to carry out what, as a minister, he wasn't able to devote his whole life to.
What is it, Camilla, about fathers, and particularly fathers and daughters?
I think it can be fathers or it can be mothers. I think the intensity of care and love and the vision that a parent has for their child can be a very powerful catalyst in a child's life. But if it's positive, you know, but the other issue is that it can be destructive and negative, and that's the crisis in many of the children that we deal with at Kids Company, is that the parental figure is toxic, dangerous, and causes harm. In our case, 81% of the children who self-refer to our street-level centres arrive addicted to substances. And of those, 90% were introduced to drugs by their own family members and often by parental carers.
What sort of ages are we talking about here?
Well, our typical arrival is an 11 or a 12-year-old who's already drug dealing or has been pulled into prostitution. And when they trust us, they take us back to their homes. And I was really struck by the descriptions that Mary Carpenter gave of the homes she visited, because they're exactly the same as the ones that we visit. So she was describing, you know, mattresses on the floor, parental carers intoxicated, absolute filth. And that's what we're walking into. I'm walking into homes and I'm finding crack paraphernalia all over the place. Even the baby soother was dipped into the crack and, you know, left on the tables. And teenagers tell us that sometimes parental carers are giving cannabis to babies to pacify them. So I think parents can be good enough, or really toxic.
We all have, I suppose, templates in our own lives for what family could be or should be. How about yours? It sounds fairly unconventional.
My family, my childhood was unconventional. We were born into a very wealthy family, and my father owned a massive sports centre which he'd built in Iran, with ice skating rings and swimming pools and dry ski and shooting, all on the same premises. And I didn't realise we were very rich. I thought that all children were supposed to be kidnapped. That was the condition of childhood. So the two police bodyguards used to arrive, pick us up in the car, my younger brother and I, because we were closer in age, and then take us to the sports centre. And we spent the whole day there, ice skating, swimming and skiing, doing things. And then we were driven back to the house. And I had this experience of incredible love from everyone that I came across, and this exhilarating freedom of ice skating and doing things. And that was kind of my early childhood. And I used to paint and send the cook out to buy the paints. I'm incredibly free. But at the same time, you know, my parents thought I was a bit unusual.
And I was... Plainly.
My mother, I think, just thought, was she given birth too? Because my mother was a very stunning-looking woman, a cross between Sophia Loren and Elizabeth Taylor, very blue eyes. And I was very conscious that, you know, she had this incredible sense of glamour. And there I was cutting the curtains and sort of safety pinning them together.
Good heavens, you were doing it even then, were you?
I was doing it even then. And I think, but, you know, credit to them, because they could have stopped me or, you know, prevented me from going down this line. But actually, they left me incredibly free. And I asked her to become a member of a psychological society so I could get the journals when I was 9. And I used to try and read these things.
Your father, your family obviously gave you every material support. How about the emotional support? It's clear that Mary Carpenter's father was more than just a breadwinner, but an inspiration, a role model for her. What was yours?
I think my real role model was actually my grandfather, who was a pediatrician in Iran. And I was aware of people queuing up in the streets to come and see him. And people used to sit, poor and rich families used to sit down the path of the whole street just to get an appointment with him. And there was something very beautiful about him, very graceful, very understated, very quiet. And I think that was the inspiration. And also I realized he made one big mistake, which was that he actually married and had a family. And really, his first love was medicine. He loved his family, but I don't think that was his passion.
Now, Mary Carpenter never did, in the end, marry, although we've evidence to think that she might have liked to. And let me read this to you.
I know, it's from James Martineau, isn't it?
It is indeed, and he said this. She always spoke like a book. She had a somewhat columnar figure and no springiness of movement. She was well-informed and unassuming. Tell me about this man's relationship with her.
Oh, poor Mary. Yes. Well, James Martineau was one of the students of Lant Carpenter's. Therefore, he lived, it was a boarding school, he lived in the house. Lant had a large house in Bristol. Lant thought that James Martineau was brilliant. He was older than Mary. He was strikingly good-looking when he was young, and Mary obviously fell for him. He showed no signs of reciprocation. He must have been about 19 or 20 at the time.
And she?
17, 18. Yeah. Mary's mother must have watched this, and she was a completely unsentimental woman. A good woman, an extremely well-ordered woman. She ran the whole household and the school under her roof. She realised there was no chance for Mary. So she simply said to her daughter, "I'm sending you as a governess off to the Isle of Wight," and dispatched her. And by the time Mary got back again, 18 months later, James had left to train for the ministry.
So fate, Camilla, in a sense, kept her from dividing her life between romance and family on the one hand and the thing that she was eventually going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I actually made a decision when I was 18. I remember thinking it's either having my own family or making the commitment to this vocation. And I decided that commitment to the vocation was what I really wanted to do.
How, Carla, did the broken-hearted Mary Carpenter get into looking after children?
She had three role models, if you like, in her life. One, first and foremost, was her father, and his influence was perhaps the greatest throughout the whole of her life. The second was an American, Joseph Tuckerman, who'd set up a series of missions in cities in Boston. He was a Unitarian minister there, and he came over and met Lant because they had similar aims in life, and Mary was delegated to take him round to show him the Sunday schools and the work that she was hoping to do down near the chapel, which was at Lewin's Mead. He and Mary walked through these slummy streets, the courts, the rookeries, the dreadful scenes, and a small child darted out in front of them. And Tuckerman stood absolutely still and said, "That child needs following to its home and looking after." And Mary recorded that 40 years later. But the third person was an Indian, Raja Ram Mohan Roy.
And you, Camilla, what led you to work with children? Was there any particular incident?
My first experience of looking after children was actually when I was 9. And in this country, it would be legal. But in Iran, the school used to leave a nursery of about 70 kids with me on my own. And they used to go for lunch. And now when I look back and I think a 9-year-old had that much control over such a large group of kids. But I used to look after those kids for about an hour and a half, and then the teachers would come back. So that was my first experience of organizing large groups of kids. And then when the revolution happened in Iran, I was at boarding school at Sherborne in Dorset. And I was actually left here with no money. Luckily, I got political asylum. Mm. And I started working in nurseries in London during the holidays, and having pocket money that way. And then from then on, I developed a private practice around Kensington and Knightsbridge. So between sort of 18, 19, right through to my universities, I was working with the children of very wealthy who were exhibiting difficulties.
So you started with rich kids?
Rich kids, yeah.
How, Carla, did Mary Carpenter get to start her schools in Bristol?
I'm very struck at a lot of the similarities between you, Camilla, and Mary Carpenter. Much the same way. When she was 9 years old, her father put her in charge of a small group of Sunday school children at the chapel at Lewin's Mead. She was good in the empathy that she showed to the children and the affection. By the time she was 18, she was in charge of all the Sunday schools, and Sunday schools were big business in the Unitarian chapels in those days. There were 7 of them. And she was trained as a teacher. Her mother was a teacher as well. So she learned her trade on the hoof, so to speak.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, Camilla Batman-Gelidge, has chosen the Victorian children's reformer, Mary Carpenter. Our expert witness is Carpenter's biographer, Carla Contractor. Carla, Mary was apparently a fervent collector of data, a documenter, of a hoarder of statistics. Why?
She met people who impressed her because they had the detail written down. Mm. She taught herself to be a statistician. She kept records of the children's homes. She kept records of where they lived. The Irish people who came in, it was the time of the Irish potato famine, and a lot of people went on ships from Liverpool and to Bristol. So she knew all those families. She meticulously researched and recorded what she found. And that goes into all her books.
Camilla, if you'll forgive me, no one ever really gives you a very hard time in interview. You're becoming something approaching Mother Teresa in the national imagination. But I've often thought to myself, well, she's very good on television. She talks the talk very well, and she dresses in this extraordinary fashion. But is she really methodical? Is she organised? What does she do? And where does she find the time between her TV interviews to do it?
Yeah, I can understand people thinking that, but I actually work 7 days a week. Mm. And I work from about 7 o'clock in the morning till about 12 o'clock at night. And I am the prime fundraiser for Kids Company. So I have to raise, along with my team, about 12 million a year. And with that, it means that you have to fill a lot of applications for funding, and you have to respond to everyone. So to give you a sense of it, Kids Company's income comes from 300 different sources every month. And first, we have to identify those sources and respond to them and put pitches in. So if you are not methodical, the whole thing will fall apart.
Mm. And always being seen on the arm of a politician must be a double-edged sword. And David Cameron went to you almost before he went to anybody else, and senior politicians love to associate themselves and their reputation with yours. Do you welcome that?
What you need to understand is that the children I'm working with are some of the most disadvantaged, disenfranchised, and ignored. Because they can't hold politicians accountable, then people get away with not meeting their needs. We've got 1.5 million children in this country being abused and neglected. Not a single politician during the election even discussed this issue. So when politicians come to Kids Company, my role is to represent the children. So I don't follow any political party. My allegiance is only to the children. But I will welcome discussions with politicians because ultimately I'm advocating for the children.
Carla, Mary wasn't actually a great communicator or certainly not a great publicist. She was rather shy, quite different here from Camilla. We've been looking at the parallels. Here's an important difference.
Yes, it is an important difference, but Mary was shrewd. There was a man who came down from Birmingham, Matthew Davenport Hill. He'd been an MP for Hull. He introduced her to the people who were at the forefront of changing things. But I think it's not just Mary. She was fortunate to start working at the time when she did. People were beginning to say, here we are, a rich country, an empire behind us, and these children on our streets with nobody looking after them. So Mary was their advocate, just as you were, Camilla.
Did Mary become famous, Carla, in her own day?
Yes, she did. She became famous first and foremost through writing. She wrote a book about convicts and how children were put in prison at the age of 8 onwards with adult criminals, and she fought against that just as much.
She had a lovely phrase, actually, yes, which was loving severity.
Yes.
This sort of robust,
yes,
love, because people associate, yes, love with you being weak, but actually genuine love has immense boundaries. And you know, I know how much I fight the teenagers I work with. They slam the door and swear at you, and you just stay there and you hang in there and you hold the standards, and then it works. They turn around.
Yes, Mary Carpenter felt exactly the same. And she used to say, in fact, she noted it in her Red Lodge journal, that if the children are harbouring dangerous thoughts, they hesitate to kiss me.
Oh,
I know. She was a shrewd woman.
I've listened to you interviewed sometimes, Camilla, and thought that you have an optimism about every child that has a sort of impossibility about it. There must be children so damaged that in the end there's nothing that one can do. And it could be trying to help those children would be done at the expense of a much larger number of children about whom it is possible to do something. I've never heard you speak about how you make the balance between those two things.
The reason most services don't get results with very disturbed children is because they see them once a week or a couple of hours at the probation, a couple of hours at youth offending,
yes,
and that just doesn't work. That doesn't bring about the change that's needed. What I think is really needed is an intensive wraparound reparenting opportunity. Where we've delivered that, we've absolutely seen emotional transformation. However, out of a cohort of 1,000, we had 12 end up in prison. And the 12 that ended up in prison were children whose parents absolutely refused to allow them to pull out of the criminal network. I remember one boy, his friends tried to burn him in his hostel when he pulled out. And he came back to see me and he said, Camilla, I can't pull out of the street because I will be dead. I might as well do this. I haven't seen a child who hasn't made progress. And because of that, you know, my team and I are committed to doing this. But it's hard, and you have to do it day in, day out, and you have ups and downs.
I'm trying to imagine, Carla, that we had Mary Carpenter in this room with us. As her biographer, you must be concluding that she had weaknesses as well as strengths. You must have concluded there are things she did wrong. Tell me about that.
I think she didn't realise her own strength. I think she didn't get the organisation going early enough. She could have called in more people. She was a parochial woman at heart. She grew up in Bristol. Her early connections and all her helpers were Unitarians and from other churches. Also, she had many other interests. I've talked about her interest in Raja Ram Mohan Roy and the Brahma Samaj and
her
India.
Her visits to India, yes. Yeah.
She wrote books. That was her key way in to influence people. But she was not a team member. That, I think, was perhaps her greatest fault. She argued with people. Frances Power Cobb, for example, stayed with her for about 9 months in her house. And Frances had a dog that used to sit in front of the fire. And Mary said obliquely about Frances herself, "Indulgent dog."
Yes.
She did not make friends easily. She didn't have time. She had no small talk. She didn't go to parties. She did not get the organisation going. She relied on her books. She relied on her parliamentary contacts, who actually, in the end, did it for her.
She got the law changed, for instance.
She did.
On the age
and
of,
many laws.
And, yes.
Many laws, not just one. A whole raft of laws concerning prisoners, young people, and looking after the young.
You've made the case, and Camilla has made the case really beyond question, that Mary Carpenter's was a great life, and in many ways, by our own age, perhaps an underrated life. Was it a happy life?
She was happy in herself. She had a maternal side to her, which was terribly important. In the 1860s, a very curious thing happened to her. A missioner from Plymouth arrived with a child with him. He tried to put the child in an orphanage, a large orphanage run by the Pastor Muller in Bristol. He wouldn't have the child because she couldn't produce her parents' marriage lines. Can you believe it? Anyway, he arrived with this child. Mary Carpenter took one look at the child at the front door of the Red Lodge and asked the child, "Will you live with me and be happy?" And this poor little mite looked up, come out of a workhouse, and said yes. And Mary then adopted the child.
Can you understand that, Camilla, with the children that you deal with? You must sometimes think, I would just like to have this child as my own and look after her or him.
To be honest with you, I haven't had that sense. I've absolutely loved these children, and I am hugely moved by them. They reduce me to tears because of what they've gone through, but also because of their courage and their dignity and their fortitude and their ability to forgive the very people who've harmed them. But I haven't had a desire to own them at all, because in my eyes, I hold the memory of that kid walking on the premises without any shoes and the indignities of the bruises on their body. Mm. And some of these children don't want to remember. So when they see me again, they know I hold that memory, and that creates shame. So sometimes they want to move away, and I completely respect that.
You've been listening to Great Lives. My thanks to Camilla Batman-Gellidge of Kids Company for championing Mary Carpenter, and to our expert witness, Carpenter's biographer, Carla Contractor. Goodbye.